I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Blues. Welcome back to The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. I'm your host, Alice, and I'm joined, as always, by my ravenous co-host, Brett.
Ravenous.
Ravenous.
There you go. I'm just so hungry.
I don't know what you're ravenous about, but...
I'm actually kind of hungry, now that you mention it.
Well, you know, you always do this keto thing, which works for you and, like, absolutely does not work for me. If I ate bacon all the time, I would just look twice as big as I do now. But, like, I don't know how you do it. It's awesome. I get to watch you eat, like, so many pounds of bacon and butter, and you just lose weight. It's amazing.
It really is an amazing thing. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it all works, but it's a crazy... It basically, like...
Wait,
I
you
just lose
okay,
a ton
this
of
is
weight.
Not medical advice, guys. This is just us bantering.
Just
so,
us
you know, hate on the bantering. This is not medical advice. But you've also done intermittent fasting, and those are kind of like the two hot fads. Which one works better for you?
Intermittent fasting didn't work at all for me.
Really?
Not at all. It's a complete waste of time. Whereas keto is like the weight just falls off. And that's great because I get to lose a bunch of weight and then do what I really want to do, which is eat ice
bacon.
Cream and pies for the next year and gain it back. And then I can just lose it again. It's a nice, I enjoy the yo-yo lifestyle. I mean, some people complain about that. That's, to me, you're just the work and then the reward is getting to gain the weight back later on.
You are hilarious.
Anyway.
That's awesome. Well, I've never tried keto. I've tried intermittent fasting, and it works a little bit for me, but I'm also not very committed, so I don't think it's intermittent fasting's fault. I think it's my fault, because it's like 12 hours, and I'm like, I'm hungry. I'm just going to have a little popsicle. How bad could this be?
Yeah, that's...
Which defeats the whole purpose.
That does kind of defeat the whole purpose, but...
But the reason this is a fitting descriptor today is we have a very interesting case today, and it's about feeding the homeless, in fact.
Yes, and thanks to Rich for recommending this topic. It's actually one that Alice and I both have a lot of experience with, weirdly. But what we're going to talk about today are some pretty common statutes, city ordinances, that actually prevent you from feeding the homeless. And that may strike you as strange, and it certainly struck the people we're going to talk about as strange, but we're going to go through it and sort of give you the reasons and talk about the law. And even if you disagree with them in the end, at least you'll know what they're about. And these have been in the news a lot lately, and I think you're going to see more and more about these laws in the coming months and years.
Right. So let's go to where this is taking place right now, where you may have heard about it. In Bullhead City, Arizona, 78-year-old Norma Thornton was arrested for an unusual crime, feeding the homeless. Thornton found herself in violation of an ordinance that took effect in May 2021 that imposes a maximum sentence of 4 months in prison on anyone who serves food to the homeless in a public park without a permit. Thornton, a former restaurateur, decided that the best way she could help the less fortunate was to put her culinary talents to work. She didn't let the law stop her. After all, she was good at cooking. She saw a need in her community. What could be so bad about, quite literally, you know, feeding your neighbor? And so she set up in Community Park in Bullhead City, and she started feeding homeless. The police showed up, and they made good on their promise under the law. They arrested her. And the prosecutor offered her a plea deal, but she refused to accept the plea deal. The city eventually dropped the charges, so she bluffed and she won. And all they did was warn her not to do it again. Thornton eventually found a piece of private property near the park where she continues her activities in feeding the homeless because she's intent on just helping her neighbors.
And, you know, a four-month sentence doesn't seem like a really long time when you work in the business we work in because we see sentences much, much longer than that. 100 times longer than that, I've seen, in fact. But when you're a 78-year-old lady who's just trying to help the homeless, 4 months probably seems pretty onerous. But this lady, when faced with this statute, she didn't back down. The police arrested her. They were going to prosecute her, and they offered her some sort of deal. And she's like, I'm not taking that deal. I'm not taking that deal. I want to go to court. I want to see this through. And as Alan said, the city kind of backed down. And we're going to talk about some more things that are happening in Bullhead City. But it's really interesting that this, as I said, this is a more common city ordinance than you probably think. In fact, whatever city you're living in right now probably has an ordinance that limits the feeding of homeless people in the parks or in public spaces around your city. And in fact, perhaps the most litigated one of these comes out of Orlando and really Florida in general. There are a ton of cases that come out of Florida and the various cities in Florida that are about this. If you live in Florida, you know it's a very outdoor state, lots of parks in the cities. Orlando has something like 200 parks. And this, you know, when you got a park, it's the kind of place where people gather. It's a natural place to do something like this. And we talked about this before when we talked about free speech. This idea of parks is sort of the commons. And it's the kind of place that people can come together and share ideas and maybe share a meal. And, you know, there's something about eating together that is both a very communal experience and an expressive experience. And that's where this comes in, because you have these statutes. And look, nobody thinks a city can't pass a statute regulating its park, right? And there's sort of two ways you could go about this. If you have a city that has a statute that you don't like, I mean, say you're an organization that wants to continue feeding the homeless and you see a statute like this come up, there are two options. One, you could launch a political campaign. You could try and get people on your side. You could try and win seats on the city council, and you could try and change the ordinance. Or you could sue. And as is probably not surprising, in most cases, people choose option number two. They choose to sue. So let's talk about this case in Orlando, because I think this will do a really good job of crystallizing this for you. So this was challenged in 2010, and it eventually made its way all the way up to the full 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The ordinance passed after residents complained that the feedings attracted large numbers of homeless people, more than 100, to the parks, making the parks unusable. And after the feedings, homeless people would sort of disperse into the surrounding neighborhoods. So basically, these people were saying, look, we don't really have any homeless people in our neighborhood. But when you do these big feedings, they're sort of drawn into the neighborhood, and then they end up sort of dispersing into the neighborhood. And I'm sure one of the things they said is you got to worry about crime and all the other various things. Of course, on the other side, you have people who say, look, I mean, we're just trying to help people who don't have anything. And okay, so you got those concerns, but isn't it more important to make sure these people have food? So you sort of have these competing ideas, and they both have their pros and cons. And maybe, as I said earlier, this is the kind of situation that's better decided through some sort of democratic action where people can debate this and decide how they're going to go. But that's not the way this went. Like I said, there was a lawsuit. The First Vagabonds Church of God and Orlando Food Not Bombs challenged the ordinance on religious freedom grounds for the church and said, like, this is sort of part of our thing, and First Amendment grounds for the Orlando Food Not Bombs. This might seem strange to you, because you might think, how is feeding people religious, or how is feeding people free speech? But as I said, when you are challenging the power of the city to regulate its park, you really need to come up with some sort of constitutional issue. You can't sue the city and say, this is bad. This is a bad idea, so therefore the court should strike it down. That's not what courts do. You have to have some sort of constitutional hook. And so these are the constitutional hooks that these people grabbed onto. And as a matter of fact, the district judge that they were in front of agreed and enjoined the law. But then a panel of the 11th Circuit, and we've talked about this before, the district court is the trial court in federal court. Then you have the 11th Circuit, which reviews those decisions if there's an appeal. You have panels of the circuit, so three judges. They will decide it initially. And then, if the issue is particularly controversial, it can go up to the full court, and that's what happened here. So this panel reverses the district court, but then that decision is vacated, and the full court gets to consider the issue.
And that's pretty rare when you take a case en banc. That's what it means when the entire court hears it. The reason panels of a federal circuit court listen is that there's usually more than three judges within a circuit, and they can kind of divvy up all the cases, and the panel speaks for the entire 11th circuit, unless the enough judges on that circuit vote to have it heard en banc or brought en banc. So very few cases per year. I mean, I'm trying to think, when I clerked, we had like four cases total out of, you know, hundreds that came across our desk that actually made it to en banc in the year that I clerked.
Yeah, we had four or five, and this was one of them. So I've got sort of a, I have a personal stake in this. I remember this case really well, and I remember this en banc argument really well. And it was very interesting, and we'll talk about some of that more, but It was an interesting experience to see this case. My judge that I clerked for was not on the panel. So, you know, when you're not on the panel, you hear about the cases that are going through the court, but you don't have any say in them. And the way this works is a judge can call for a vote of the court on whether or not to hear it en banc. And I remember when this call was made, one of the judges asked to hear this en banc, and basically all the other judges kind of look at the issue and decide, is this something that is worth the court's time? It's a big deal to do en banc. You bring all the judges together. It's hard enough to get three people to agree on anything, right? I mean, sometimes you only get two and then you have a dissent. Here, you've got 11 judges who are trying to decide this case, and you can have multiple dissents, and you can have a majority opinion and then a bunch of concurrences. I mean, it's just a really big deal. And one of the things you do as a clerk is you look at the issue and sort of decide, is this something that's worth our time? And there were some really interesting issues in this case. And, you know, spoiler alert, the court's going to dodge all the interesting issues. But there were some interesting issues that made it an interesting case to take on banc. And, you know, I think you can probably already see that, like these just sort of things you never really thought about.
So the groups argued that feeding the homeless was expressive conduct. It was, in effect, speech. So even though feeding, you know, the action of, say, scooping soup into a bowl is not actually using words, they're saying that doesn't matter because that can be speech because it's expressive. They also argued that they had a religious obligation to feed the homeless, which the ordinance impinged. And so to show that this has some religious bearing, it's not just, you know, you'd like to do it, you basically to show that in order to properly eyes your faith, to have freedom of expression of your faith, you have these tenets that you have to fulfill. And they're saying that one of the ways that we fulfill what we believe is by feeding the homeless. And because the ordinance prohibits us from doing it, it is actually tamping down on our freedom of religion. Now, the Orlando ordinance not only required a permit, it limited the number of permits anyone could receive for any particular park to two a year. So they're saying you can do it, but you're very limited in how you can do it.
And that's a really important part of this, because you can imagine how getting a permit, if the process is fair and neutral, isn't that big of a deal. So in the law, even though you have rights, you can think all the different rights you have, whether it's freedom of speech or freedom of religion or the right to bear arms or the right to assemble, I mean, whatever it is, they're not unlimited. They're never unlimited, no matter what they are. They always have restrictions that governments can put on them. So, you know, we've talked about how you can, the park might be a place to speak, for instance, but that doesn't mean that you can go down there every day and bring 1,000 people and speak every single day, all day long, right? I mean, the city would be able to say, look, you know, the park's not just for you and your followers to hang out in. Or religious freedom. I mean, you may say, look, part of my religious freedom is I got to sacrifice babies. And if I'm not, you know, burning babies in the fires of Moloch, then you're impinging on my freedom of religion. And the government can say, well, okay, we get that. But one of the things we're going to require is that you not murder anybody as part of your religion. I mean, there's always limits that you can place on people. And a permit is about the lowest level of a limit you can put on somebody. Like I said, as long as it's easily available. So if it were just a permit, if it were just, you got to go down to City Hall that earlier that week, pay $10 and get a permit, that's not that big a deal. But it is a problem for these people that you can only get two a year for any particular park. And their main park is the main park in Orlando. And the Vagabond Church of God is basically a church made up of homeless people that sort of gathered in that park for its religious services. And then they also had this feeding. So you can see this is a very sort of important thing to these folks. And those of you who, you know, are Christians or whatever, know that part of the New Testament is helping the homeless, feeding the homeless. I mean, it's a very big thing. And so they're saying, we have an obligation to do this, and you are making it impossible for us to do it. Not harder. You're not putting some minor limitation on it. You're making it basically impossible. And because you're doing that, it's different than just saying, you got to get a permit. It's very much a restriction on our ability to do these things.
Yeah, that's a great point, Brett. We look into all of these different things because you can see the argument, as Brett has said, just how restrictive something is. And just two a year, and not just two a year, but two for anyone, you know, you can see how that's much more restrictive than sure, you know, get a permit before you can have a parade, but you can have a parade any day of the week. Now, when the 11th Circuit considered the issue, they decided to assume, for the sake of argument, that feeding the homeless was expressive conduct. So they didn't even dive into the issue of whether it was speech. They just said, let's assume that feeding the homeless is in fact speech. It's speech. In doing so, they're actually dodging, like Brett said, the most interesting issue, because like, it's an open question. It's not obvious on its face that the action of serving food to the homeless specifically is expressive conduct rather than just conduct. Instead, they decided that because the ordinance was a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction on expression, it was permitted. So just so you know, this happens a lot in the courts. I think they knew how they were going to come out, and so they could dodge the most interesting question. They don't have to actually wrestle with the difficult question of what was speech, because that could have implications for the future, huge implications for future cases, because they know how they're going to come out here. They knew that they were going to uphold the ordinance. So basically, why, you know, wade into the confusing First Amendment thicket of what speech is if we can just assume for argument, but we are not bound by this as a holding in future cases, and we can deal with it when we are forced to deal with it in a future case and just reach the ultimate conclusion, which is to uphold the ordinance.
Yeah, which as a law clerk, that was all well and good because it made it a much easier thing.
Much easier opinion to write.
Exactly.
and by the way, much easier opinion to get others to sign on. Remember, we're not just talking about three judges like in a panel that is the first kind of line of defense for appellate courts. We're talking about all the judges on the 11th Circuit, and you need to get enough votes. You know, this isn't just getting 2-1 if you have a panel. You have to get enough judges on your side to vote with you so that you can uphold the ordinance. So if you're able to skip that thorny issue of what is speech, you're much more likely to get others to sign on.
And interestingly enough, this did end up being a unanimous opinion that they issued, because they really did kind of dodge the question. And I think it's kind of interesting that they dodged the question. We're going to read you a section from this opinion, and then we're going to talk a little bit about it. And I'll be intrigued by whether or not this is persuasive to you. So here's the reason that they said this is a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction. Now, as I said, you can have restrictions on your rights. And this is how they're normally framed. Reasonable time, place, or manner restriction. So you can have a permit to the park, but you can't have it every day. You can't have it at 3 o'clock in the morning. You can't set up loudspeakers that will blast everything you're saying across the city. These are all reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. So because of that, even though it's limiting your speech in some way, we're going to say that's fine. And that's really just the jurisprudence. I mean, the Supreme Court has basically said that. That's the way it is. A lot of these cases come down to that. And back to sort of clickbaity things, you'll sometimes see, you know, Supreme Court or court says, you're no longer allowed to pray in the park, or you're no longer allowed to hand out leaflets in the park, destroying the First Amendment, something like that. And in fact, this is what it is. It's no, you can still do those things. It's just, we have these restrictions on you. So Let's read what they said. And thinking of everything we've pointed out at this point, the number of permits you can get, the situation of this group, here's what they said. First, Orlando Food Not Bombs does not contest that it is within the power of the city to enact ordinances that regulate park usage. And of course, they don't contest that because that would be a loser. As we said at the beginning of the episode, there's just no question the city can do that. And unless you have some sort of constitutional hook, you're going to lose. Second, the city has a substantial interest in managing park property and spreading the burden of large group feedings throughout a greater area, and those interests are plainly served by the ordinance. So, there's sort of the begging the question. We talk about begging the question as a fallacy sometimes. And begging the question means you sort of assume, for the sake of your argument, one of the premises you're actually supposed to be proving. And you don't actually prove that premise. You just assume it's already been proved. And it leaves people who listen to your argument thinking, well, yeah, but why is that necessarily true, right? I mean, that's what it literally means, is a logical principle. I mean, ordinarily people use it just to mean it raises the question, which is fine. And I get annoyed when people get annoyed by that. But anyway, that is the logical fallacy. So this one, so the city has a substantial interest in managing park property, sure, and spreading the burden of large group feedings throughout a great area, okay, and those interests are plainly served by the ordinance. Yeah, but I don't think the issue was that they were saying you cannot put any limitations on us. The issue was you're saying 2 a year. And is that a reasonable way to, quote unquote, spread the burden? The idea being, if you can only do it twice in this park, when you do it the next time, it'll be a different park. And then a different park and a different park. And that's all well and good. But once again, there's one big part, one main park. And twice a year might seem pretty restrictive. But the court is just kind of eliding that. They're not really getting into that. They're just saying, hey, well, you know, this clearly works towards that. Third, the interest of the city in managing parks and spreading large group feedings to a large number of parks is unrelated to the suppression of speech. So they're not out there. You know what? This is, once again.
That really begs the question.
Once again, yeah, it totally begs the question, right?
It begs the question because you skipped the question of what is speech.
Yeah, I mean, you've skipped the question of what is speech. You've also, you're just taking the city at its word that the only reason they're doing this is to protect the parks from damage, and not because they don't want homeless people in the park at all, ever, well, if they can help
it. And that's
it.
Really interesting. I'm sure this came out. I haven't read like the transcripts at the district court level, but I'm sure this was aimed just at the homeless, and you could have as many birthday parties where you fed a large group of people who are not homeless, probably. At some point, those people are not getting arrested for feeding kids like hot dogs.
Right. I'm sure you could. But, you know, I'm sure this was strictly enforced against the homeless. And it was interesting, it was an as-applied challenge. So, to get even more technical for everybody out there. So, a facial challenge, you're saying the statute is unconstitutional on its face. There's no way to apply it that doesn't violate the Constitution. That's not what these people are saying. They're saying, as applied to us, it's unconstitutional. So the fact that you're targeting the homeless, the fact that you're preventing us from being able to do that, that is targeting the homeless. And I think the district court really would have disagreed with the court on this, that, you know, the problem is you essentially have a circumstance where the city is able to proffer a reason for what they're doing, but the real reason is sort of hidden. And this is just sort of a fact of constitutional jurisprudence. A lot of times you see this, where if the government can put forward a reason for what they're doing, even if you suspect that's not the real reason, it's good enough. It's like, we don't look beyond sort of what they've proffered to us. We take them at their word, see whether or not that's objectively true, and then we go with it. And so that's kind of what's happening here. They're basically saying, look, we can't tear up the parks, and if we have the homeless there more than twice a year, well, then the parks are just going to go to hell. It'll be the end of the parks. Nobody will ever go in the parks again, which is another thing. What if they said one time a year? What if they said no times? What if they said, look, in order to protect the park, you can never feed the homeless in the park? Because one time feeding the homeless in the park is just too much damage, costs too much money. You can't do that. There's nothing that we've read so far that would prevent them from doing that, right? They've given you a good reason why they're doing it. They're not doing it on the basis of speech. And sorry, you're just not going to get to do it at all. Anyways, I'm dwelling on this, but the fourth reason. Fourth, the incidental restriction of alleged freedoms under the First Amendment. It's kind of funny because they assume for the sake of argument that it was speech, and then they act like it's totally not speech, right? I mean, just the way that's written. The incidental restriction of alleged freedoms under the First Amendment is not greater than necessary to further the interest of the city. So here you might say, okay, well, that's what they're saying. If it was one, it would be. Or if it was zero, it would be. But no, that's not what they're saying. And you know that because of the next line. We cannot replace the city as the manager of its parks, nor decide how much protection of parklands is wise and how that level of conservation is to be attained. And which at that point, they're basically saying you could ban them altogether. And sorry, that's still a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. Because who are we to say? Who are we to say that whatever the city has told us about the parks isn't good enough? The city is in a far better position than this court to determine how best to manage the burden that large group feedings place on neighborhoods in the city. So,
you know what's so interesting about this decision is, you know, we just talked about as applied and facial challenges, and this is an as applied challenge, yet the opinion is written as if to fend off a facial challenge, even though a facial challenge would be much, much higher of a bar. And so it's just I'm a little bit surprised that this was unanimous, to be completely honest. You don't have to, you know, delve into any inner workings of the court at the time you were clerking, but this is actually a very broad opinion for an as applied challenge, because usually an as applied challenge is, you'll see a much narrower opinion, basically leaving the door open for a future challenge in another situation where it could be unconstitutional, like if the city completely banned all permits for serving the homeless. So I don't know. That's just an interesting, I didn't follow this case at the time when it was at the 11th Circuit, but it's just a very, very broad opinion, especially when it's dodging. It might just be that some people didn't pay as much attention because it didn't delve into the issue of free speech, into what was speech.
As I recall, without revealing any secrets, as I recall, the panel decision basically said it's not speech. So they were willing to say, look, this is just not expressive conduct, which is a thorny issue. What is expressive conduct? So obviously speaking is, writing is, podcasting is, releasing a video on TikTok. That's all expressive conduct. But sometimes standing silent is expressive conduct. Sometimes maybe feeding the homeless is expressive conduct, particularly if you're trying to make a point. People make points in all sorts of ways. This, you can see how this feels like it's right on the borderline, right? Is feeding someone expressive? And I think the court on the panel was willing to say it's not. And I think that's one of the reasons. It's unusual, for instance, for a decision to go en banc and then you end up with a unanimous decision, unless the unanimous decision is narrower than the panel. Because if everybody agrees with the panel decision, they're not going to take it en banc. If some people disagree strongly with the panel decision and it goes en banc, usually it's going to be a pretty strongly divided court. But here, you kind of have the court saying, well, we're just not going to get into that issue. So you can imagine people who would disagree with this argument, who are on the court, are willing to accept it because the alternative might be a 6-5 decision saying it's not expressive conduct at all. And you don't want that. That's even worse. So I think that might have had something to do with how this one eventually comes out.
Indeed. And now this was an 11th Circuit decision we were telling you about. But we started this episode out by talking about Norma Thornton, who lives not in the 11th Circuit, but in the 9th Circuit in Arizona. And remember, she had called the bluff, the prosecutor, and the prosecutor's like, this is not great jury appeal. We don't want to go through with a trial on this. So they dropped charges against her. But Norma, the fighter that she is actually suing in an attempt to overturn the Bullhead City Ordinance. And she can do so because she will be in the 9th Circuit, which is over Arizona, and is not bound by the 11th Circuit precedent. We've talked about this, where the different circuits can be persuasive to each other, but they do not have to be bound by the circuits. And if you have a circuit split, meaning the circuits come out with different legal positions, those types of cases can only be resolved by the Supreme Court. Otherwise, you could just have splits that continue into perpetuity until the Supreme Court decides to resolve it, if they so choose to do. So that's what's that's what Norma is doing now. It'll be interesting to see how the Ninth Circuit comes out on her case and whether they will agree with the 11th Circuit or disagree with the 11th Circuit on this.
And Alice, I talked about my personal connection to this case. Do you want to talk about your personal connection to it?
Mine is a little bit more tangential, but there were a couple. So there are usually ordinances from two perspectives, but all geared towards the same thing, which is feeding the homeless. On one kind of reason for the ordinance is they, quote unquote, are controlling the crowds. Really, they're trying to keep homeless populations down, right? But the other way that you can explain these ordinances is to say you want to protect the homeless or anyone being fed, especially maybe in certain cities. They don't want to say that it's directed at homeless people, but they want to say we want to protect everyone who's being fed, that the food they're eating is safe. You know, there are certain standards for a restaurant or for a grocery store to maintain healthy foods in order to sell you. And just because people are getting it for free doesn't mean that they should be susceptible to salmonella, for example. So just so you know, no matter what the reasoning is, I think they're getting at the same sort of issue we've been talking about here, which is not to create big hordes of homeless people in a certain area in a neighborhood. So in college, I felt very strongly that, you know, we had all this food that was being thrown away in our sorority houses, fraternity houses, and our school generally. And my school was located in one of the poorest zip codes in Appalachia. And those of you who are familiar with Appalachia, it's a very different kind of poor. It's not urban poor, but rather rural poverty. There are people who live in the Appalachian Mountains who came over from England and still to this day speak a version of Elizabethan English, because they've been so kind of isolated within the mountains that they really haven't developed with the times in terms of, you know, even running water and electricity. And so they do come, you know, into town a good bit, but they live a very separate life. And poverty and is pretty rampant in many parts of Appalachia. And so my school was situated kind of in one of the poorest parts of Appalachia and, you know, had lots of tuition paying students and lots of food. We had all these sorority houses, fraternity houses, and they would have trays of food that at the end of the day, by law, they would just throw away. And so I thought, you know, why can't we repackage this food that's never, you know, left the kitchen and serve them to so many people in our community who needed them? But we kind of face these ordinances where you can't just take these trays of food, stand outside and open up a soup kitchen outside. The city wouldn't allow it. And so I started a nonprofit. I, along with a lot of other people, helped start a nonprofit where we literally did that, took foods and, you know, maintained all the regulations, the federal, state, local regulations you have to have in keeping the food serve safe. The certification we all had to get was serve safe certified to keep the food at a certain temperature, to heat it up at a certain rate, and to store it in a way that restaurants do to maintain kind of the integrity of the food so that we could then serve hundreds of thousands of meals over the course of a school year to people in our community that otherwise would have been thrown away. So we were able, you know, because we had a bunch of students working for free to create this nonprofit and serve these foods, we were able to kind of work around the ordinances. But had it not been for that, I mean, you can see the argument that Norma has here. I mean, this food quite literally would have gone to waste, and it was perfectly good. It never left the kitchen. It wasn't on someone's plate and you were just, you know, giving someone leftovers. Food that people would pay good money to eat and we were having to throw away. So anyways, that's kind of my little side story of my younger days of facing this issue and recognizing that not everyone has an army of students to work for free to create nonprofits. And then, you know, I drove so many hundreds of miles over the years to pick up all this food in like refrigerated, you know, packaging to make sure that the temperature stayed safe so that we wouldn't be in violation of the law.
Yeah. And look, I mean, this is a complicated issue. If you live in a city, you know, it's complicated, and it's very easy to demonize the cities for these regulations because they seem cruel. And you'd kind of like the cities to try and deal with the homeless quote unquote problem in some other way that maybe alleviated it as opposed to just pushing it around or pushing it out of the town. But it is something that you see all over the country. And like I said, your city probably has some sort of regulation like this. And, you know, it's just one of those things people don't talk about. This is one of those issues people don't like to squarely face. You know, they don't like to have political discussions about this, because a lot of people, they want to help the homeless, but they don't necessarily want the homeless living right outside their front door. You see that a lot. And I don't really know what the answer is to any of this. I think it's interesting that it's becoming sort of a constitutionalized issue. And maybe that is in part because people don't want to deal with this stuff through sort of the political process. So they're kind of passing the buck to courts and saying, you deal with it. You tell us whether we can do this or not. And if you say we can do it, then we'll just assume it's good. That kind of thing. And I don't know. It's a tricky issue. And when Rich asked us to do it, I was like, oh, I don't know. Is that, how interesting is that? But then when I looked at it, and the more we looked at it, the more interesting it is. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this sort of dive into these laws as this issue sort of develops in Arizona with Norma's lawsuit. We'll keep you informed. And if it somehow sneaks its way up to the Supreme Court, we'll cover it then too.
Indeed. And Brett, you just made such a good point that this is really a political issue that has found its way to the courts because of, you can come up with your own reason of why it may be difficult to deal with in the political sphere. And we see this happen with more than, you know, this homelessness issue. And that's why sometimes it's kind of a strange, you know, constitutional issue to square away with the actual political problem and why it's not a perfect fit. Because we've talked about this before, the judiciary isn't really supposed to be the legislature. And sometimes when they're maybe forced into those political questions, there's a little bit of legal gymnastics that has to happen. And sometimes we see that in the opinions. So we hope you guys have enjoyed this episode. And we just thank you guys so much for always giving us the most interesting things to talk about, whether it's on Legal Briefs or on our other podcast, the Prosecutor's Podcast. You guys keep us going and keep it coming. Before we sign off today, Brett, do you have anything else to add?
I just want to reiterate that it is really helpful that you guys point out things that you want us to talk about. The other podcast, in some ways, is easier to do. In some ways, it's harder because it requires a lot more research. But the topics are just endless in the other podcast. Whereas this one, making sure that we've got interesting topics every week is a little bit of a challenge. So it's really helpful when you guys point out things that you want us to talk about. And I hope you'll continue to do so.
Indeed. Well, you guys have a great day. And until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. Called me, hey little girl, you better stop it or I'll call the judge on you.
So that's kind of what I did, but it was the other way. Like, the guy was a jerk,
yeah,
and yeah, had been being a jerk, and we were like 4 hours into our 7 hours, and he was like, I'm done with this, I'm leaving. And I was like, you're not leaving.
You can't leave.
I know. And so we started arguing back and forth, and it was one of those moments. This happens to me every now and then. I very rarely get mad, but sometimes I do. And I got mad, and I like pounded the table, and I was like, sit down right now. I'm gonna call the judge, and I'm gonna have you sanctioned. And the guy sat down.